So welcome to Quantum Theory at Psi. I'm Joseph Emerson, and this is, I think, my fifth time giving this course. And the idea of the course is to introduce you to the kind of mathematical and conceptual foundations of quantum mechanics. The emphasis, this is just a three-week course, so the emphasis is not going to be like practical things like perturbation theory and so on, but more looking more deeply at the fundamental structure of quantum mechanics, as I mentioned, both from the conceptual point of view and the mathematical point of view. I'm in the Department of Applied Math at the University of Waterloo, and I specialize in quantum information and quantum computing. My background is actually in physics. I did my PhD, well, all my degrees were in physics, and I did my PhD in quantum foundations, quantum chaos in particular, focusing on understanding how classical physics emerges from quantum theory. And no, Ehrenfest's theorem is not the whole story for that. It's actually very subtle, especially when you look at complex systems. And you can learn a lot about the nature of quantum mechanics by pushing it in those extreme limits, which is a lot about what's done here at Perimeter Institute. Then I switched to quantum information for my postdoc when I went to MIT, and then I did a postdoc here at Perimeter Institute, also working on quantum foundations and quantum computing. And so I continue to work on those two areas as an academic over at the University of Waterloo. Because those are my interests, this course will be slightly skewed towards examples and concepts from quantum foundations and quantum information. So I apologize to those of you who are interested in condensed matter theory, for example, or string theory, because those are not topics that I delve into very deeply during these lectures. Okay, any questions to start out? Requests? All right, so for today's lecture, I'm just gonna kind of give you a little bit of motivation of kind of why I think you should love quantum theory as much as I do, why I think it's increasingly societally relevant and increasingly relevant to our understanding of science and the nature of reality. So let me just start by kind of giving you that motivation. So as all of you know, there are two fundamental pillars to modern physics. Okay, on the one hand, we have quantum theory, and by quantum theory, I mean a very kind of broad sense of the word, including quantum electrodynamics and essentially the standard model by extension, and general relativity. So we're obviously focusing in this lecture on the quantum theory portion of that, and also a very narrow portion of it. So what's remarkable is that both of these theories have been tested to with incredible precision. And not just tested, but confirmed, have been validated. With remarkable precision. So first, let me say that to make predictions, quantum theory is, these are both dynamical theories. To make predictions, quantum theory has to be supplemented with the specification of fundamental forces. So if you don't know the laws of electromagnetism, or if you don't know, you know, the the strong force or the laws of the weak interaction, then you can't make predictions with quantum theory alone. Quantum theory has to be supplemented with a theory of fundamental forces. So these forces can be fundamental. Such as, you know, E and M, or they can be effective forces. In engineered systems. And of course, in other case, these forces come in through the specification of the Hamiltonian or Lagrangian for the problem. So let me also make a remark that quantum theory makes essentially two kinds of predictions. So Q is short for quantum. It makes structural predictions. And in fact, most of the early tests of quantum theory were of this structural form, such as the spectrum of the atom. So here we understand from the mathematical structure of quantum theory that we get operators, observables or operators acting on a Hilbert space, and we'll see that in depth in this class. And we necessarily get a discrete spectrum for Hermitian operators, and that discrete spectrum accounts for physically observed discrete phenomena in the micro world. And then we assume by extension that in the macro world, where we see continuous type phenomena for energy scales and so on, that's just an artifact of not having sufficient resolution. And the other aspect of the quantum mechanical picture is statistical predictions. This is via the Born rule, which we'll see also in depth. For example, the double slit experiment. So in terms of the motivation for studying quantum theory, in my opinion, quantum theory is the most successful theory ever devised by humanity for a couple of reasons. On the one hand, there is an incredible breadth of phenomena that quantum theory has either explained or predicted. So maybe we can warm you guys up a bit by we can brainstorm a bit on what those things are. So let me get you started. So some examples. Um, How about the band gap structure and solid state physics of the PN junction? Which is relevant to microcircuitry. There is laser physics. Lasers are now ubiquitous, even though like 30, 40 years ago they were big and clumsy and expensive, and now you can buy a laser pointer for $5 at the dollar store, maybe less. What else do I have here? Superconductivity is a uniquely quantum mechanical phenomena. We have a whole bunch of methods of medical imaging based on, for example, MRI scans, which require a quantum mechanical description. What else can you think of? Where we needed quantum theory to either guide the design or predict a phenomena that's had a big impact on society. I'll let you guys think about that a second. How about,
Photography, quantum photography,
true. That's actually been experimentally demonstrated and has been used in practical settings. What else? We're in Ontario. What's keeping the lights on? Of course, there's the hydro dam at Niagara Falls, but we also have nuclear power. Pardon me?
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. There's several nuclear power plants in the province. How about the chemistry behind drug design? The quantum chemistry. Which has life-saving capabilities. So the list goes on, but this gives you a sense of, we have this theory which was developed in the 1920s, and now, close to a century later, it's relevant in a pervasive way. Pervasive has a negative connotation, but it's broadly relevant to society and modern technology. So all of these practical applications which make the world a better place require quantum theory. A theory which was originally developed by scientists trying to understand things that were not even observable yet, such as atomic structure. So how do I bullet this? A and B. So B is, quantum theory is also enormously successful, as I mentioned earlier, because of the precision of its predictions. It's incredible to be able to make the kinds of predictions that quantum theory can make. So consider, for example, the electron anomalous magnetic moment. Which is quantified by the G factor. And the way to characterize this typically is you use a parameter A which is g minus 2 over 2. Classically, we expect g to be 2. This is the ratio of the spin to the magnetic dipole moment of the electron. And so we have the experimentally measured value of A is 0.001159652180 73 to a precision of 28 in the last two digits. And the theoretical prediction based on calculating the fifth order perturbation theory in QED agrees to 1 part in 10 billion. So that's pretty astounding that a mathematical theory can describe such a precise empirical value. However, so of course, what goes into this? What goes into this is quantum theory as it will be formulated in this class through a series of three axioms and the standard model, which describes the fundamental forces of the world. So the agreement is an affirmation of both of those theories. However, G for the muon has been measured to a similar precision, and there is a slight gap. So we have experimentally for the muon, let me just write it this way, for the muon, we have G is equal to 2.002331 8416 plus or minus 13, and the theoretical prediction is 2.002331 8361 10. So it turns out these differ by 3 standard deviations. Now, I didn't look up before class what that corresponds to as a probability. What is the statistical probability of having such a discrepancy just through the randomness of statistics? So I don't know if it's 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000. I'd be interested to know that, but I didn't get a chance to check. The more physics I do, the more I realize that old saying is true, that there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. So you've heard about how there's kind of a bit of a crisis in statistics in terms of not reporting negative results and so on, where I think there was an XKCD comic about testing whether, sorry?
Whether
jelly beans cause, what was the connection?
Cure cancer, maybe?
Whether jelly beans can cure cancer. And then you know how it works, right? So if you typically, you have a positive statistical result, if the results agree to within some precision and that you're confident that's correct 19 times out of 20. So you get a team that goes out and tests if red jelly beans can cure cancer, and they find it doesn't work. And they test if green jelly beans can cure cancer, and it doesn't work. And they check if yellow jelly beans can cure cancer, it doesn't work. And it goes on and on and on. You can read the full XKCD comic. But of course, eventually, by the law of statistics, one of the jelly beans is going to positively correlate. One of the colors of jelly beans will positively correlate with showing that it's an effective cure of cancer. So you have to be very careful with statistical anomalies. There's also sociological effects. So beware of statistics and why I quit high energy experimental physics. So I did my master's in high energy experimental physics. And I was excited about, understanding this fundamental structure of the world and being involved in discovering these things. And so the first problem was, of course, that as the kind of low man on the totem pole for my master's, I spent the first 6 months of my research polishing aluminum so we had a really good vacuum seal on our detector. Okay, that wasn't fun. And then I wrote a numerical simulation to test, to vet the performance of the detector, and realized that the original group had over-designed the detector by a factor of 10 because they forgot to take into account Bayes' rule. The job was to distinguish electrons from pions, and they wanted to design the detector to have a certain confidence level in that distinction. And it turns out that no one took into account the fact that electrons were 100 times more likely than pions a priori in the experiment, which meant that they over-designed the whole thing by a factor of 10, which was only $1 million mistake, but that's not a big deal. But even that, I was still trudging on, wanting to make a career out of experimental high energy physics. And then a theorist named Howard Trottier at Simon Fraser University pointed me to the particle data book when I was complaining to him about the fact that it seemed like the 100 people working on this experiment, we had people from MIT, I was at Simon Fraser University, we had people, the experiment was done at DAISY, which is in Hamburg in Germany. We had groups from Caltech, we had groups from Europe. And it seemed that nobody really had a complete understanding of the full experiment. Everyone understood some local piece, and you hoped that that patchwork assembly of local knowledge overlapped enough that there was a coherent understanding of what the experiment was doing. But I was starting to seriously doubt that. And so Howard Trottier says, well, have a look at the particle data book, and you might get some affirmation of this. So in the particle data book, they give the historical measured values of fundamental input parameters to the standard model and other important fundamental rates, such as, you know, beta decay or whatever. And what's interesting about that is that there's about 20 or so plots you can find in the back pages of this journal. And the plots all start out, you know, around the 1950s when people started doing these experiments rather intensely, up until, I guess this was around 1990. I was doing my PhD in the 1990s, my master's in the 1990s. And about a third of the plots show a phenomenon like this. Some group goes and measures, this is some parameter, some fundamental, doesn't matter which one, some fundamental parameter of the standard model. And they do a measurement, and they find that they get this value, and they give nice error bars saying we're sure with high probability it's within this interval. And then a couple years later, another group of 50 or so people gets funding from the NSF or whoever to do another version of the experiment with better precision. And they get this value with these error bars. And then a few years later, another group gets money and starts doing a similar experiment with different techniques. And then they maybe get this value. Then a few years later, another group comes along and does the experiment, and they find this value. Always, the error bars are always getting a little bit better. Then a few years later, another group comes along and finds this value. And continues. And then it asymptotes over here with tiny little error bars. So this is not a statistical fluke. What this is your supervisor did the previous experiment, or your colleague who's reviewing your paper did the previous experiment, and you know if you disagree too much with their result, it's going to make them look bad. So that's my interpretation of a plot like this, and you guys can look it up. So that's what I think about this. I'd say it's a coin toss whether we're seeing new physics here or whether it's people not doing their statistics carefully enough. And I'm sure it was subconscious, by the way. I'm sure of it. So I quit experimental physics and switched to theory. So, here's the fun part now. our work is not done. Quantum theory is not a closed book. In spite of my skepticism about something like this, there is an incredible opportunity in quantum theory right now, and you should all be very excited about that opportunity. So let me tell you what I see as important concepts and questions going forward. So one, we have incredible advances in quantum technology. So back in the 30s and 40s, people did experiments in physics and did them in the aggregate, in the bulk. You were looking at bulk phenomena for the most part. The control was very limited. Even in NMR, where they control individual spins, that was in the bulk. There's 10 to the 23 spins in the ensemble that you're studying. That's totally changed. Nowadays, we have precise control of individual quantum systems in various modalities. Those modalities can be superconducting quantum circuits. They can be Bose-Einstein condensates. They can be entrapped individual atoms. So I have a collaboration with Rainer Blatt from Innsbruck, who's one of the world-leading ion trappers. We have a collaboration where we're demonstrating a 7-qubit error correction code to create one logical qubit with very high fidelities, very good performance. While I was visiting him most recently in June, he asked one of his grad students to show me kind of his pride and joy experiment that he's had running for 10 years straight, where it's the only experiment in the world where he can trap a single atom in a Penning trap. Actually, maybe it was a Pauli trap. I don't know enough of the details. But it's a single trapped ion, and it's so strongly trapped in this parabolic-shaped potential that they can shine a strong laser on it so you can see it with the naked eye. You can actually see it. You look into the setup through the window in this high vacuum trap, and it's complete darkness, and in the middle there's a bright spot, and it looks like it's like a starry night where there's only one star in the sky. So I think that's amazing that we can actually see an individual atom with the naked eye right now due to the level of control we have. So this is going to enable increasingly precise tests of quantum theory and all kinds of technology. This is enabling, it's enabling for technology. Two, is that there is we're still discovering the enabling capabilities of quantum theory. So we already know about superconductivity and fusion and lasing, which have been known for decades. But just, you know, within the last 10, 20 years, we've discovered the capability of quantum theory for information technology. And it's a little bit of a funny thing. I've always been a bit of a Luddite. So what drew me to quantum information technology is actually the fact that I'm interested in quantum foundations. And quantum information technology provides a very precise way of understanding the differences between quantum theory and classical theories by looking at the power of quantum systems to perform computational tasks, information theoretic tasks, that classical devices cannot perform. And so for me, this shines a bright light in a new direction in understanding what is it about quantum theory that's different, and what is it about it that's enabling. And in my opinion, we haven't even understood the full power and impact of quantum theory because we don't have a conceptual understanding of quantum theory. And you'll hear more about that throughout the course. In addition, we need to find ways to develop high TC superconductivity, which will be a huge benefit to society. And maybe quantum information technology will allow us to discover methods for achieving this. With quantum information technology, let me just say that I think we don't understand what are the full capabilities. Things like Shor's algorithm and Grover's search algorithm were discovered in an almost haphazard way, I would say. They're kind of single spots they're isolated cases, rather, where we see that quantum theory provides an advantage. But we don't have a systematic understanding of the kinds of problems that quantum theory will help with. And at the experimental level, we have the challenge of finding ways to precisely control these systems to achieve the advantages of quantum computing. Number three, how to unify quantum theory with gravity. That's a huge question that's unanswered. And it's not just a principled thing where we want to just have some nice, cozy little theoretical framework that we can write down on a piece of paper and be happy with. There are, you know, phenomena which require simultaneously a coupled interaction between gravitational effects and quantum mechanical effects, such as black hole evaporation, which leads to the information paradox for black holes. So there are practical scenarios where we need to understand how to unify these things. And my personal opinion is that we're not going to know the best approach or the right approach to do this until we have a better understanding of what kind of theory quantum theory is. And by that, I mean this old question is, are the states of quantum theory, are they physical states or are they knowledge states? We don't even know the answer to that question. Or are they some mixture of the two? So until we understand the answer to that question, I don't see how we're going to answer this question. So that's my motivation for the quantum foundations aspects of my research. One of them. One of the motivations. And that leads us to the next topic, which is understanding the conceptual nature of quantum theory. So what do I mean by that? A couple of things. First, where does quantum theory come from? Here, I don't mean was it delivered by some alien spaceship. What I mean is I'm going to give you mathematical axioms for quantum mechanics, which are all you need to know to do quantum mechanics. So you're going to hear about algebras of observables, about Hilbert spaces, unitary operators, and commutators, right? That's pretty much going to give us the structure of quantum theory. Well, compare that with the situation for special relativity. You know, originally we had the Lorentz transformations and they were just posited as ansatz. But then Einstein came along and said, well, look, we can actually deduce special relativity from physical assumptions. Let's assume as a physical fact the laws of physics. Whoops. All right, just a little technical difficulty here. Do the people in the control booth have the capability to fix this?
Yes, it might take a minute though.
Okay, go ahead. I can I can check my email or something. No, okay, so what was I saying? Right, what is special relativity? So we assume the, thank you. We assume the laws of physics are the same in every reference frame. And then we assume that the speed of light is constant, and we get the Lorentz transformations. So we start from physical principles, and we deduce the mathematical axioms. That has not happened for quantum theory. For quantum theory, we have the mathematical axioms. So people understand the importance of this question, and people have been trying to answer it, and there's been various frameworks put forward to try and deduce the mathematical axioms from physical principles. People have tried information theoretic principles and other types of principles. Let me just highlight some work here by Lucien Hardy, who is one of the pioneers in this area. And he has a recent paper proposing a solution to this problem, which I'll point you to. So the point here is we want to find physical axioms, find physical principles rather. So I think a satisfactory answer to this question will go a long way to helping us with these other exciting problems. We have all these fascinating paradoxes of quantum theory. So we have on the one hand Bell's theorem, which we'll discuss in this class. Which suggests a moral conflict. Maybe the word moral is misleading. Which suggests a conflict not with the empirical predictions of special relativity, but with the spirit of special relativity. And so we'll examine that in some detail later in the course. There's also the contextuality of quantum theory. Which denies that measurements reveal pre-existing values for quantum phenomena. By values, I mean physical properties. So you often hear, how many of you have heard of contextuality? How many of you have heard of Bell's theorem? Great. So contextuality is kind of like a generalization of Bell's theorem in a broader setting. And it doesn't actually specifically address relativity, but points to a problem of assuming that measurements reveal pre-existing values. It's often characterized as saying it denies that pre-existing values exist, but that's not what it does. Okay, so part of my job in this class and part of my personal life mission is to destroy myths about quantum theory, okay? So no, quantum computing does not get its power because it computes things in under physical parallelism, okay? That's just not true. It's not a scientific fact, certainly, and it's probably not true in any case. Similarly, contextuality is not about pre-existing. No one has proven that pre-existing values can't exist. Physical properties can't exist underlying quantum theory. Rather, we know that those pre-existing values have to satisfy certain constraints, and one of them is that measurements don't reveal them in a clean way. Is that so surprising? If you're baking a souffle in the oven, and this is an example from Lucy and Hardy, if you're baking a souffle, any small perturbation can make the souffle collapse. So if my method of checking if the souffle is done is to open my sticky oven door and look inside, and that causes the souffle to collapse, what I see is a collapsed souffle. Does that mean that the souffle was collapsed prior to me observing it? No. It just means there was a fundamental disturbing nature to my measurement. And so really, that's all contextuality tells us. People often present it as a no-go theorem. And von Neumann had similar no-go theorems in the early 30s that were wrong, that basically led the whole community to think that we can't go down this path. Bohr chastised us not to do it. Von Neumann claimed to have proven it was impossible. And they were both wrong. So in particular, just to kind of shamelessly promote some of my own research now, what we've recently shown, what my group has shown, is that contextuality plays a role in explaining the power of quantum computing. So if you're interested in this kind of thing, please come talk to me, because I'm always looking for good and motivated students. And so let me just give you the journal reference. And part of our reason for looking at this part of our reason for looking at that is we feel that there's a need to understand more deeply what it is about quantum theory that powers its advantages for computation in order to discover the full set of advantages that quantum theory offers for quantum computation. It's also relevant for the resource structure of quantum computing. Building a quantum computer is hard. There is decoherence. Quantum coherence is fragile due to decoherence mechanisms, which we'll study in this course. And so you need optimal ways to use your resources, your quantum resources, to kind of get the most bang for your buck with the physical hardware you have. And understanding the resource structure of quantum theory through things like contextuality can guide us in that endeavor to find the most efficient way to use noisy hardware to achieve quantum information technology. So the summary of this then is a wanted poster, which is what's needed is a new generation of curious physicists to tackle these problems. So the rumor has it that in the late 19th century, Einstein was told that he shouldn't go into physics because it was a done deal, it was a done field. Well, that's certainly not true now either. There are a huge number of open questions and enormous opportunities to leverage the capabilities of quantum theory, both for engineering challenges, for fundamental challenges, and for clarifying understanding of the physical world. So I guess I'll end on that note, inviting you to work hard and study hard and learn as much as you can and ask me tough questions as I go through some of the mathematical structure of quantum theory.
could have left that, I guess. So, now my approach to teaching quantum theory is to emphasize the operational nature of the theory. So I really want to stress how the mathematical elements connect with operational facts, not with abstract metaphysical notions. Because I think that we don't have the correct grasp of the abstract metaphysical notions to understand quantum theory. So given that we don't know that, let's not put false ideas into your minds. Let's actually just focus on what we do know about how the mathematical formalism connects to experimental phenomena. So from that point of view is called the operational framework for quantum theory. But maybe I should pause a second, and before I launch into this, are there any questions about any of these kind of broad, big picture ideas that I just discussed? Yes?
Where does QFT fit into all of this?
Well, QFT is the marriage of quantum mechanics with relativity. So we can describe relativistic effects, and it's central to the standard model and to understanding high-energy physics experiments and things like that. So in this course, we're going to discuss non-relativistic quantum mechanics, which is a special case of field theory. So that's going to be our focus. Do they get a quantum field? Do you get a quantum field theory course? You must, yeah. Two, okay, yeah. So this is the non-relativistic setting. And so it's fairly well understood how non-relativistic quantum mechanics emerges as a limit of the relativistic version, the field theory version. Yes?
Are there like blueprints for relativistic quantum computers?
People have looked at that. There's also some arguments about how relativistic effects could be problematic for maintaining the coherence of a quantum computer. But, you know, building them in the non-relativistic limit is hard enough. I don't know if there's much enthusiasm about exploring doing that in the relativistic limit. Did I answer your question correctly? I don't know.
I was wondering if like there are plans for it.
No, I wouldn't say any plans, but there are researchers who work on that kind of thing. Yes?
So I got the feeling that most people that work in this field also look into philosophy of science. Is this true, or is this completely...
Most people that, sorry...
That ask these kind of questions are also doing research in philosophy of science, because a lot of this seems to be not just mathematical, but...
Well, first of all, this was mainly motivation. For the mathematics of the course, the nuts and bolts of the course. Nowadays, you see a lot of physicists working on quantum foundations. Perimeter Institute one of the great things about Perimeter Institute is that it kind of actively supports that area, which isn't a traditional area that's supported in physics departments. And in the past, it was very heavy with philosophers, and as a result, not very sophisticated research was performed. That's recorded, unfortunately, but that's the reality. So things are improving. Like, thanks to the work of colleagues of mine, we now have much more precise mathematical theorems and so on for understanding these issues. Any other questions about the big picture or the... Yeah?
What's an information state as opposed to a physical state?
If you have a dog and your dog likes to be in three different rooms in your house, and before you get home, I ask you, where is your dog? And you'd say, well, based on my experience, there's a 1/3 probability it's in the living room, 1/3 probability it's in the basement, and maybe a 1/6 probability, well, I'll make it 4 rooms so it's not a uniform probability, 1/6 probability it's in the backyard maybe, which is enclosed, and 1/6 probability it's somewhere else, the den. So your description of the dog's location before you enter into the house is a probability distribution because you don't know where it is. So that is a state, like a statistical state. It's your description of where the dog is, and it's a probability distribution, not a specification of an XY coordinate in the house.
So if you specify the dog's location via an XY coordinate, then that's the physical state of the dog, of its location. And the probability distribution is an information state. So it's the difference between what you know about the outcome of a die roll before you roll it versus after you roll it. And so the question is, are quantum states states of knowledge about the possible locations of an electron, or is it the actual physical state of the electron? So that's a distinction which scientists kind of failed to make for about five decades. And in fact, my PhD supervisor, Leslie Ballantyne, took the mantle from Einstein, who was a very strong, and Schrodinger, who were both very strong advocates that we should think about quantum states as states of knowledge, not as states of reality. And it turns out if you think about quantum states as states of reality, it leads to a whole bunch of conceptual paradoxes which just go away like a poof of smoke if you think about them as states of knowledge. And while I'm on a rant about this, let me just add Schrodinger's cat. People usually quote Schrodinger's cat. Oh, you imagine a cat penned in a box and blah, blah, blah. If I measure it, then all of a sudden it's, you know, it's simultaneously alive and dead, but if I measure it, then it's in one or the other state. So the idea that the measurement causes, that the cat has no definite physical state, that its quantum state is some kind of physical superposition of these two different physical states, and that that is changed physically into a definite state on measurement via this collapse of the wave function. So you can believe what you want about that, but just to kind of restore Schrodinger's name, if you go back and read the article, his very first sentence in that paragraph is, if you think about quantum states as physical, you are led to absurd conclusions such as this. And no one quotes that first sentence as though Schrodinger was promoting that point of view. And actually, one other comment about that. It seems like he actually stole the idea from Einstein, because sometime earlier, Einstein had sent Schrodinger a letter because they were corresponding because they were so upset about Bohr and his influence on people's thinking about quantum mechanics. They thought it was just wrong-headed. And Bohr somehow won the debate, and the textbooks reflect Bohr's views. So Einstein was writing to Schrodinger about ways to convince their colleagues that this was not the right way to think about quantum states. And he describes a scenario to Schrodinger where you imagine a mouse in a box, and in the box there is some TNT and some kind of radioactive device which either triggers or doesn't trigger the TNT with 50-50 probability based on the coherent superposition of an atomic decay, and actually says something like, so one is left to this absurd conclusion that the mouse is somehow simultaneously alive and blown to bits. And then Schrodinger adapted that to something, I think, that was much more effective at catching on. So just to get the history straight there, the giants of the field thought that quantum states were states of knowledge. And that's an important open question, but we won't go into it too deeply because that's not what this course is about yet.
So it is an open question, right?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
In college they make it sound like they already know, right?
Yeah, and there's papers that come out every year proving that quantum states are physical that are all wrong, including good friends of mine do that. And I write them nasty emails saying you're misleading everyone, and they say they want nice papers. So, let's just take a deep breath, get back to the math. Okay, so we're going to take this operational characterization exactly to avoid these pitfalls, these conceptual pitfalls. So we'll avoid conceptual claims. We're just going to talk about empirical facts and how the math connects with empirical facts, exactly so that we're not committing to assumptions we don't need to make. Okay, so the idea for this is to think about quantum systems in terms of experimental or empirical procedures. So you imagine, say, a box with a go button on it, and then the box has a dial on it. In principle, it can have many dials, but for simplicity, we'll write one dial. And then the dial has various settings. And you can choose a setting of the dial, and you press go, and then an invisible system comes out of the box that you can't see unless you're in Reiner Blatt's lab. And then you can have another box. So we call this a preparation box or a preparation device. Now,
Now this box has a dial on it. And it accepts as input some invisible system. And it has an exit for that invisible system. But you can set this dial and affect a transformation. So this is a transformation box. And then last but not least, we have a box with an indicator light on it and a dial. And it also has a readout. So this is a pointer. And this is a measurement box. So the challenge is to come up with a mathematical framework which can take as input the parameter set by the dial settings of each device and predict the readout. And it turns out that's impossible. But what we can do is come up with a mathematical framework which predicts the probabilities of the different readouts. So then, empirically, we find that for some, in fact, most settings, of the knobs, well, let me put of the control knobs, which are parameters, the pointer output is random. Okay, so we can't even hope to construct a theory that's going to make a deterministic prediction because we know that theory will be wrong. Because we know experimentally that we get statistical variation in the outputs. So at the very start, we're aiming for a theory that's going to describe the statistics. And when we do have it, for some parameter settings, we will find deterministic output. And in those cases, the theory should produce such a deterministic prediction. Okay, so we do have this theory, and now I'll launch into presenting a theory which correctly describes this, which is quantum theory. And again, we're stuck doing this with mathematical axioms rather than physical principles because there are open questions. So, postulate one or axiom one. Is that any setting of the preparation device can be described by a Hilbert space vector.
Okay, so the key word here is described and setting. Okay, so compare that with what you might have learned from your undergraduate textbook, which is that the Hilbert state vector is the system exiting the box. Okay, notice the change of language. Rather than saying the quantum state is this invisible system that came out of the box, we're saying the quantum state describes the setting of the preparation device. More generally, you can think about that as the configuration of the system based on some knowledge you have about the parameters describing that configuration. Okay, so now we do a little bit of math review. Now, historically, one of the challenges in this class has been that there's a very wide variance to the mathematical background of the students. So this is something where I need your feedback. We need some back and forth. I guarantee you, because this, well, based on an experience of teaching this 5 times, there are going to be students who are going to complain that the mathematics is not advanced enough, that I'm reviewing simple math. And there are going to be students who are going to complain that it's too advanced. Okay, so please understand that if you're on the shoulders of that distribution, that you have to accommodate the fact that I'm trying to address the kind of the bulk of the class. So, but it takes back and forth. So please feel free to ask questions, either about more advanced questions or basic questions. The best way to find the right pace is for you guys to take advantage of the fact that you're in a lecture, you're not watching it online, so you get to ask questions and clarify things and explore deeper concepts if you're interested in doing so. And it makes the lecture way more fun and interesting for me if I feel like you guys are interacting. So do not hesitate to interrupt at any time. I love it. So a Hilbert space is a vector space, is an inner product space, which is, of course, a vector space with an inner product. And so I'll skip that detail, assume you know that, but please ask if you don't. Is an inner product space that is complete in the norm. Now, typically, many students don't know what this means. By a show of hands, how many of you know what complete in the norm means? Okay, a small fraction. So complete in the norm is a technical condition. So before I get to that, let me just recap. Okay, you all know what inner product is, so I won't recap inner products. Complete in the norm means that I'll just say what it is first. So conceptually, or in words, what it is the requirement complete in the norm is the requirement that the limits of all Cauchy convergent sequences are elements of the space. Okay, so you're in some sense your space is complete. If you have some kind of convergent sequence defined by the elements of your space, the limit of that sequence is also in the space. Okay, so you don't run into problems with having elements of the space that are lacking. So this is important for completeness, is important, for example, for lots of mathematical theorems. So what's a Cauchy convergent sequence? So a Cauchy convergent sequence is a way of talking about convergent sequences without knowing what their limit is. So a Cauchy convergent sequence
Thank you.
is one satisfying the following. So it's a sequence such that, okay, so ST is such that, let me just actually specify the sequence. So we index the sequence of states by some integer, and then we say that we demand that the norm of any two elements of the sequence approaches zero as both m and n approach zero. So you can see that we want the vectors to close, the vectors of the sequence to get closer and closer to each other as we go to the limit of the sequence. So we can talk about convergence in this way, this approach is zero, without knowing what the limit of the sequence is. And so if we can find sequences such that this is true, then the limits of those sequences should be elements of the space, and that is a nice condition to have mathematically. Now, of course, this typically doesn't matter in the sense that all finite dimensional Hilbert spaces.
Sorry?
Yes?
You mean M coming to infinity?
Pardon me?
You mean M coming to infinity? Or did you write infinity?
I couldn't hear you.
The integers M and N tend to.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. So all finite dimensional Hilbert spaces are complete in the norm. So this is a non-trivial condition only for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Yes?
So it doesn't matter how fast m or n are going to infinity, at whatever independent rates, that goes to zero?
Yeah, correct.
Define a Hilbert space as being reducible in the norm, and then say that it ought to be complete in the norm.
Pardon me?
If you define the Hilbert space as being complete in the norm, then surely the last point you write down is like obvious?
A Hilbert, well, a hint, oh, sorry. All finite, yes. You guys are good, I like this, okay. All finite dimensional inner product spaces are Hilbert spaces. Well, we're completing the norm and therefore Hilbert spaces. Good, thank you. So here's the thing. So quantum mechanics is actually, the mathematics of quantum mechanics is incredibly easy for finite dimensional systems because it's just linear algebra, and the linear algebra is so simple for finite dimensions. It's when you worry about infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, which we need to describe continuous systems, continuous degrees of freedom, that things get complicated really fast. And it's actually a bit of a rabbit hole. Like you can, the more I try and understand the mathematics of infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, the more questions I discover that I don't know the answer to. Now it could be that the universe is finite, and as I mentioned an hour ago, the notion of continuous variables is a fiction. It's just an approximation to discrete variables where we can't see the granularity. In that case, all the mathematics of infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces is not fundamental to quantum theory, but just a set of convenient tools for approximating systems that look like they have continuous variables. So we don't even know the answer to that question. And one of the beautiful things about working in the fields I do is that you can basically look at all the interesting problems in finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, where the math is super easy, and you just have to know how to diagonalize and calculate eigenvalues and things like that. But because infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces are kind of such a common tool in so many areas, we will spend some time familiarizing you guys with some of these mathematical subtleties of infinite dimensional Hilbert space, of which there are many. You know, you all know that, I'll mention that later. Okay. So for quantum theory,
We only need what are called separable Hilbert spaces. So here, this has nothing to do with entanglement. This is a different note, a mathematical notion of separability. How many of you know what separable Hilbert space means? A small fraction. So a separable Hilbert space is an odd term. What it means is that every basis is countable. Okay. So this means that every every orthonormal basis is countable. So I don't know where the word separable comes from, but that's what it means. Now, of course, a finite dimensional Hilbert space, that's true. So again, this is only a non-trivial constraint if we think about infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And then you see something right away that's interesting, which is, what about position and momentum? You all learned about the eigenstates of position and momentum. So what are the eigenstates of momentum?
Plane waves,
exactly. So why is this interesting? Consider the plane waves, e to the ikx, with some normalization. OK, so this is the position representation of the momentum plane waves. We learned in third grade how to expand a quantum state in terms of the plane waves to describe tunneling, right? How did you do that when I'm telling you that we're working in Hilbert space and we only have separable Hilbert spaces? Think about this, the harmonic oscillator, the simplest physical system of all time. What we can describe a state in the harmonic oscillator as a expansion over the plane waves. But what are the energy eigenstates of the harmonic oscillator? Come on, this is fourth grade.
They're discrete.
They're discrete. They're also the Hermite polynomials. So the Hermite polynomials are the eigenstates of energy for the harmonic oscillator, and they're discrete. So all of a sudden, we have one basis, which is discrete, which is the energy eigenstates, and we have another basis with scare quotes, which is a continuous set. So we're certainly not going to have a matrix similarity transformation that's going to take us from one basis to the other. So already you see that the seeds of the contradiction there exposes the fact that the plane waves of momentum are not a basis for the Hilbert space. They're not an orthonormal basis or even a basis for the Hilbert space. And that is pointing to a very deep and subtle fact about infinite dimensional quantum physics, which is that the textbook quantum physics you do is kind of breaking the rules of quantum mechanics. And there are actually two solutions to why you can do that. One is Dirac's solution, which is to enlarge the Hilbert space. And we'll discuss this next class, to enlarge the Hilbert space to include these overcomplete bases of continuous elements. And the other approach to de von Neumann preserves the idea of separable Hilbert space, but develops a fairly complex mathematical machinery to accommodate the position and momentum operators. The position and momentum operators are not self-adjoint operators. Okay, so that means, and so they don't have countable bases. Their eigenstates aren't a countable basis for the Hilbert space. So that's a mathematical technicality we'll get into next class. Just a heads up, you may have been notified already, but I will be away Wednesday and Thursday, and so there are going to be double lectures of general relativity on those days. And on Friday and Monday, we'll have double lectures for quantum theory. So on that note, thanks for your attention. I look forward to getting more questions from you guys in the coming weeks. And enjoy the rest of your week.